Welcome to the Geopolitical Horizons, the podcast from thegeopolicy.com. Today we want to look at a region that doesn't actually get much media attention compared to the likes of the Middle East or Africa, that of the Americas. That's North America and Latin America. In this series, we've looked at different regions in the world, and the Americas is the last one and probably the least known of all regions. Here to discuss this with me is Geopolicy founder Adnan Khan. I'll be honest with you, Adnan, I don't know much about Latin America, and I'm sure that's probably the same for most people.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. It's probably the least covered in the media. Probably doesn't help the fact that it's on the other side. At one time, the New World, as the Americas was called, was somewhere everybody wanted to go. It was this unique area. But since then, as you mentioned, the Middle East, Africa, Europe seems to get more attention than the Americas. But nevertheless, the superpower, America, is over there. And it's one of the regions in the world. So that's why, if you want to have a good understanding of the world, you need to understand all the regions, and the importance of regions can increase and decrease over time. And the Americas is another region, and that's why it is important we do cover it. But yeah, definitely with all the regions we've covered, this is probably the least known, or most people are the least informed about this.
Let's get straight to it then, Adnan. What are the region's key features? That's where we normally start.
Yeah, so the Americas consists of North America, which is the US, Alaska, Canada, and Mexico. And then you've got South or Latin America. And this begins with Mexico and stretches 7,000 miles through Central and South America, ending on the Cape Horn, where the Pacific and the Atlantic Oceans meet. So if we begin with North America, the center of gravity of the global system, it shifted after the fall of the Soviet Union to North America. Prior to this, Europe was the center of the global system. Now, I say North America, Yusuf, rather than the US, because as in Europe, over the course of centuries, the leading nation on the continent can change. It can vary. The United States is enormously powerful, but it shares North America with two other nations, Mexico and Canada. And all three countries share a single characteristic. They have access to both the Atlantic and the Pacific. So Asia does not have ready access to the Atlantic, nor does Europe have ready access to the Pacific. North America, whoever the countries are there, they both have access to the Pacific and the Atlantic, and that's what makes it very, very unique. Now, what makes the US stand out above everyone else in both North and South America is the Mississippi River system. This is the largest continuous river system of farmland in the world. It's what made the US, from an agricultural perspective, self-sufficient. And the river system is navigable, which is very important. It's the cheapest way to transport goods. So if you have a river system, if you have lots of agricultural land, then you can really become economically self-sufficient. What it also means is that the US didn't have to rely on the global system like many other countries. We've talked about Europe. Europe had to go out and colonize the world. America didn't need to have everything It had everything it needed within its borders. So what we find with the US is settlers from Europe, they came, they conquered, they hit gold, literally, with Mexico and South America having lots of gold. And these settlers are today what is the United States of America and Canada. Now, another country that doesn't get talked a lot about in North America is actually Canada. That's probably because your neighbor is the global superpower. And Canada, it's really similar to Russia and Australia. Russia and Australia are vast countries, but most of these countries are uninhabitable due to their climate and terrain. So from a population perspective, Canada is actually a very small country if you take away all the unlivable areas. So what you find, Yusuf, is most of the Canadian population actually lives within 100 miles of the American border. Canada is a huge country, goes all the way up to the Arctic. But most of this territory, no one lives there. It has a population of 35 million, despite how large it is. So that's Canada and America. So the other country you've got in North America is Mexico. And what you find in Mexico's population centers are in the south of the country, around Mexico City. So the north, where it has a border of America, is sparsely populated. There's another reason why large areas of Mexico are not populated, and that's because most of the country is rugged. It is desert. It's hard for people to live there. And that's why you find you. So the north of Mexico is actually ungovernable. And this is the area where you find various drug cartels, which I'm sure we're going to come back to. So things could have turned out very differently, Yusuf. If Mexico had dominated North America, it would have been the global superpower. If I remember, Yusuf, up until at least 1850, most people in the world believed Mexico would become the power in North America. But what happened was they lost a war with Texas. And when Texas joined America, America went to war with Mexico. And at that time, Mexico's borders went all the way to California. It was a huge country. That was why people believed Mexico would be the superpower. But in the end, history went in the direction that it did. And then finally, use of Latin America. Again, as I mentioned, it begins from Mexico, goes all the way to the bottom of the continent where Chile is. That's about 7,000 miles. And it's widest from Brazil to Peru. That's about 3,000 miles. But whilst Latin America is a huge island, it consists of 33 nations. It's not actually a single entity. What you find is you've got a massive Amazon rainforest in the middle of this continent, and you've got loads of mountains. So really what you find is this is not one continent where all the countries share borders and population centers like Europe. What you find in the north, you've got Venezuela, and that is completely separate to Brazil. And then on the other side, you've got countries like Argentina and Chile. So although when we look at a map, you've got one big continent, really this continent should really be viewed as three different continents. And that's why when the Europeans came to colonize Latin America, they found it really, really difficult. Even today, Yusuf, you find in Latin America, most of the main cities are on the coastal areas. These are areas where Spain and Portugal came, and they settled there, and these became the cities eventually. So Latin America is a very disconnected geographic landscape, which is very different to North America. So that's really the key features of the Americas. And these features have a big impact on how this region engages with each other and the rest of the world.
You touched on the history of this region with the extensive amount of gold in this area. Could you tell us a little bit more about this history, please?
With the Americas, Yusuf, we can probably divide the region's history into three periods. So if we take the base period to be when Christopher Columbus turned up, 1492, you've got the pre-Columbus period, so from the 1000 up to 1492. Then you've got the colonial period, which is 1492 when Columbus came, up to about 1800. And then from the 1800 onwards to today, you've got the U.S. epoch, the rise of the U.S. So those are the three probably best ways we can arrange it. Now, for most of human history, west of the European continent was considered impossible. So if you ventured out too far, people used to believe you'd fall off the edge of the earth. Now, interestingly, the first contact with the Americas was before Columbus, actually, was in 1000 by the Vikings. And they actually sailed from the British Isles to Greenland. And from Greenland, they went to what was known as the north of America. Now, they abandoned their colony after a few years and they came back to Europe. And many people in Europe heard about the expedition, but they were viewed as legends. And at that time, in 1000, Europe just didn't have the technology to make such a large, long journey. But the other thing was for Europe, the Mediterranean was the center of the world. It was the center of the region. So for them, the center of the world was Europe, and the center of Europe was the Mediterranean, and the center of the Mediterranean was the church. So Europe was busy with their religious wars. And aside for some trade with India and China, they didn't really venture out too far. Now, in 1492 was when Columbus landed in, I think, what was Haiti. And what Columbus was actually doing is on behalf of the Spanish who funded his venture, he was trying to go around the world to China. And at that time, people believed the earth was round, but nobody had physically proven it. And the reason why he was trying to go around the world and not take the normal route, which was through the Mediterranean, was the Muslims controlled that region. So the Ottomans had conquered Europe. You had the Ottomans, you had the Safavids, and you had the Mughals. They controlled the key region of the world. So the reason why we found out about Americas was because someone was trying to circumvent the trade route and get around the Muslim routes. And he landed in Haiti, and he saw the indigenous people. And we get the name Red Indians because he thought he had got to India. Columbus thought he'd got to India. He saw people dressing a certain way. So they came to be known as the Red Indians. Obviously, eventually they worked out that they didn't get to India. They found a new land altogether. So this was the first contact, really, or the modern contact between the world and the Americas. So Columbus, he eventually gave way for the Spanish and the Portuguese colonists. And what Europe found was well-developed civilizations in America that operated completely independently of Europe and Asia. There also existed two empires, the Inca and the Aztec empires, and these were the center of gravity in the region. So the arrival of Spanish conquerors led to the fall of these empires, and this is what brought the pre-Columbian period to an end. And what started after that really was the colonial period. So this was when Spain, it colonized the lion's share of the New World. The Spanish Empire controlled everything west of modern-day Brazil, and Portugal controlled most of what is today Brazil. And what they found was lots of gold and silver mines in these places. All of Central America was in Spanish hands, as well as the territory that became the modern U.S. states of Texas, Arizona, California, and New Mexico as well. Then eventually after this, the French came and they colonized the Mississippi area and Quebec in Canada. And then eventually the British came as well, the English, and that was what turned into the United States of America. So the English, actually, when they came, Yusuf, they funded, it was, I think, the Virginia Company, a limited company. They funded a settlement in America. And in 1607, the first band of Englishmen, they built a permanent settlement in what eventually would become the United States of America. So they actually settled in Virginia. And then 150 years later, they wanted independence and they rebelled against the British crown. And that's what became the original United States of America. You know, the quarrel and the want to be independent is really what led to them actually becoming independent in the end. So what you find, Yusuf, is the US government, it really was just on the edge of the eastern side of the US continent. And what they realized is if they want to survive, they need to expand all the way to the Pacific and they need to kick out the European colonists from South America. Now, that was a tall order at the time because a lot of America was under the control of Mexico. So that's why what the US did was it engaged in wars, it engaged in a number of struggles in order to win the whole continent from them. So the pre-Columbus period, then you've got the Columbus period and the colonization, and then the rise of the US. These are probably a good way to look at the history of this region.
Latin America, Adnan, it still seems to be on the left side of the political spectrum. Many South American leaders, they advocate leftist policies. Cuba is a country that always comes to mind. Why do you think this is?
So a lot of this really has to do with the dominance of the US over the Americas and the Cold War. So the US was always worried about external influence over Latin America. So when the Europeans were colonizing it, they were worried about that. And then during World War II, the presence of German agents and sympathizers in South America with the Nazis, that became a big issue for American strategists. And then as soon as World War II finished and the Cold War began, the US became concerned about the Soviet influence and spread of communism in the region. And that's why America intervened on many occasions to block the rise of lefty leaders. Now, Cuba, it made and it still makes a lot of headlines. However, it's never really been a challenge to America. But what makes it important is its location. Now, America's prosperity was founded on the Mississippi River system. This allowed farmers to ship their agricultural goods to the East Coast and then to Europe. All of these goods, Yusuf, they have to flow to New Orleans and then they're transferred on ocean-going vessels. So these vessels have to go past Florida and past Cuba. So because Cuba sits on the sea lines of a key route of America, who controlled Cuba was always very, very important. So in 1898, the U.S. first intervened in Cuba and effectively made Cuba a colony. Half a century later, when pro-Soviet government emerged under Fidel Castro, Cuba became a centerpiece of the U.S. strategy. Now, you know, geopolitically speaking, the Cold War shaped the last 50 years of Latin America's evolution. Latin America was the battlefield for the Red Scare. And that's why today many people and leaders in Latin America are on the left. But the political tides, I think, have changed now. The left has been a failure. Look at Venezuela. Venezuela has an inflation rate of 10 million% at one point. But lefty populism would probably never fully leave Latin America because it resonates too strongly with the people there. And because of the dominance of America's economic system and capitalism, many people see the left as an alternative to that.
So one thing that always comes to mind, Cuba, is the Cuban Missile Crisis during the Cold War. Can you tell me a little bit more about that? Was that actually a threat to the US?
So the Cuban Missile Crisis is quite an interesting period. It's all to do with the Cold War. What you had was you had a government emerge in Cuba that was supportive of communism. And what the Soviet Union tried to do was station missiles there. And as I mentioned, Cuba sits on the sea lanes to the world for America. So if Cuba was to fall to the Soviet Union, that would be a massive problem for them. So what actually happened was, is Soviet Union tried to station missiles there, potentially nuclear weapons, and that's led to a standoff between the two countries. What actually happened was, is in America, not everyone was on the same page. John F. Kennedy actually was horrified when he became the leader of America of how much money was going to the military industry and how many nuclear weapons were being built. However, the army pushed his hand. They were the ones that had intelligence that Russia was doing this. And as a result, Kennedy had to be seen to be dealing with this. So eventually, if I remember, an agreement was made where the Soviet Union would withdraw, and in return, America would withdraw its missiles in Turkey. Effectively, Turkey for America was the same for the Soviet Union was for Cuba. So yet today, many people reminisce how close we were to war, how close we were to nuclear war. I think when I was studying this at university, it was like we were on the verge of a nuclear war. It never happened, nuclear war in the end. But for a lot of people, we were pretty close. But it was all part of the Cold War, really.
Let's look at some of the other countries in Latin America. We briefly spoke about Mexico and how it was looking like it was going to become a superpower at the time. But what role does it play now? Because, again, it doesn't seem to have much power.
So when we look at any region, when we look at any nation in this region, Yusuf, its relation with the U.S. are key. As the U.S. has so much dominant presence in the region, each of these countries, their relationship with the U.S. is actually quite critical. So in the case of Mexico, it's had a complex and often violent relationship with the U.S. throughout its history. So in 1850, Yusuf, as we mentioned, Mexico was viewed by many to be the nation that would be the superpower in the region. And in 1850, Mexico's territory went all the way into the U.S. The border that we have today was due to Mexico's loss against the U.S. In a war. As I mentioned, Yusuf, the northern portion of Mexico has always been underdeveloped and underpopulated. And it's even more so in the 19th century. The land running from the border both north into the U.S., and south into Mexico, it's intensely dry and desolate. As a result of that, it makes it hard to govern over this particular area. As a result, Mexico's actually found it difficult to settle people there, a support population in the north of the country. And that's why today cartels dominate this particular territory. Mexico, Yusuf, is America's second largest trade partner after China. But really, it's got two key exports to the US, immigrants and drugs. Now, Mexican immigration is very different to Irish and Polish immigration to the US. These people, the Irish, the Italians, the English, they are from Europe and they traveled very far from their homes to go to America. So when they settled there, they assimilated. Mexico is different. You said Mexico shared the border of America. So when Mexicans go into America, they don't necessarily see themselves moving to a new land. In fact, they look at America or the south of the United States and they see this as something that used to be their land in the past. So what you find is when Mexicans go into America, they're not necessarily breaking ties with their homeland. So this is the root of the anxiety that Americans have. In America, I think currently you serve just under 50% of America's population is non-Caucasian. In the next 10 to 20 years, the Caucasian population will become a minority. And with population growth, this is causing a lot of anxiety in America. It doesn't help that the Caucasian population's fertility rate is falling, so they're all being replaced as well. So America has a very tricky relationship with Mexico. There's a lot of anxiety about Mexico. Donald Trump's campaign when he ran last time was on, I'm going to stop illegal Mexican immigration. So there's a very troublesome relationship on America's southern border.
And now one thing I do think about when Mexico comes to mind is the cartels, drugs. There's various Netflix series on these issues. How come this region is blighted by such things? And why is this region unique to this?
So the reason why this region has its own specific narcotics reality is because cocaine use is derived from the leaves of the cocoa plant. And three countries, Colombia, Peru, and Bolivia, they account for all the cocoa harvested in the world. So this is very unique. You don't have that in any other part of the world. An ingredient that's used to make narcotics, all of it is in three countries in one particular region in the world. So in effect, Yusuf, heroin, cocaine, marijuana, the drugs of choice, they originate as extremely low-cost agricultural products that require quite low and cheap processing. And then north of Latin America, you have the United States of America, which has a population of over 300 million people. But that's a massive market that has a huge appetite for narcotics. So this was just too good a business opportunity to give up for Latin America. So as a result, organizations emerged over time to cultivate, to process, to transport, and sell to customers in the US. So for a long time, use of the Colombian cartels, such as the Medellin and Cali cartels, they dominated the cocaine trafficked into the US. So Pablo Escobar, famous guy, was the leader of the Medellin cartel, and he's notorious for this. And what he did and what the Cali cartel did, well, they set up cultivation facilities in Peru and Bolivia, as well as Colombia, and they transported the narcotics via the Caribbean to the US. Mexico, Yusuf, interestingly, at that time it was a land route, but it was secondary. The Mexican syndicates, they received a fee for each kilogram they transported, but these organized crime syndicates, they eventually took over from Colombian cartels from the 1990s. And the reason for this was because the US did a crackdown on the Caribbean corridor, which was the main route for the Colombian cartels. So official estimates, Yusuf, it puts the amount of money that flows into Mexico today from the sales of narcotics, it runs from $25 billion to $40 billion a year. Now, to put that into perspective, if Mexico is exporting $300 billion to America, the average profit they're probably making on those exports is about $30 billion. So the profit made from narcotics is the same or more than the normal exports. So that's why there's a massive narcotics trade in this particular region.
I'm guessing with that market being so lucrative, it's very difficult to actually deal with the cartels in these in this area.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, in origin, Yusuf, narcotics starts as a very cheap agricultural product. And at each stage, the price rises and the profits increase. So the selling prices and the profits of cocaine is over 10 times the cost of production. So that's why there's a lot of competition over the supply routes by the different cartels. Now, whilst we do have an image that Mexico has been taken over by cartels, the truth is, Yusuf, that violence from cartel war is generally concentrated along the border. It's not in the populated areas, the heartland of Mexico. And also the enormous amount of money from narcotics finds its way eventually into the banking system and the general economy. So it does have an impact. But yeah, the cartels are heavily organized. They have heavy military equipment. They're able to bribe officers. I mean, Pablo Escobar actually was an MP in Colombia for a little while as well. He had a lot of money. And for a lot of people in Colombia, he was a Robin Hood type character. So, I mean, we can probably do a whole podcast on the cartels, actually. But it is a reality due to the specific ingredients that are only present in that particular region. And as a result, a lot of money, you know, the opportunity was too good to give up for many.
Adnan, whilst we're on the subject of economics, why was the NAFTA established and what's its impact? And what's its impact been on the wider region?
So when the Cold War ended, Yusuf, the US sought to engage the region more broadly by calling for a free trade zone in that particular region. With the Cold War, America was more focused on Europe, more focused on Asia. And really, once the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, America saw the need now, you know, we're in a new era. We want to globalize the world. And that's when America established the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, amongst the US, Canada, and Mexico. So it was negotiated in 1992, and then it began to be implemented in 1994. In effect, Yusuf, what this agreement did was it integrated Mexico and Canada into the US economy. So Mexico was seen as a cheap alternative to produce goods for the American market. Now, this has had a negative impact on much of America's Midwest. So with whole industries shutting down because it was cheaper to produce goods in Mexico. So you'll find, if you remember, Yusuf, when Donald Trump came to power, he talked a lot about renegotiating the NAFTA deal with Mexico. And what he actually did, he didn't renegotiate, he imposed a new agreement. So if I remember, what he's done is he's made it a condition for goods to get reduced in, to get a reduction in taxes and tariffs, a certain amount of the goods have to be produced in America. So for, if you think about it, Yusuf, you know, for America, you've got two countries around you, they're developed countries, so why not enter into economic agreement for them? But the economic agreement, it serves America more than it does Mexico or Canada.
If we talk about Venezuela now, go a little bit further south. Venezuela was throughout the 2000s a loud and recurring challenge to the US. This all seems to have gone horribly wrong now. What's actually happened to Venezuela since?
So Venezuela, much like Cuba, it managed to attract a lot of attention by appearing to be a significant threat to the US. The reality was, Yusuf, it never was, despite how loud it was. So Hugo Chavez, he came to power in 1999, and he proceeded to gain a lot of support in the region with his anti-US rhetoric and his left-wing positions. His economic model was to use the revenues from the high oil prices to fund welfare programs and import food. Now, the problem was once oil prices started to fall in 2010, these programs were no longer affordable. So Venezuela fell into a lot of problems, and hyperinflation reached 1,000,000% in 2018. I mean, it completely crippled the country. Now, the issue was, you said, the Venezuelan economy, it depends on oil exports. And the reality of geography and logistics make it inevitable that Venezuela's main market for oil exports is going to be the US. So despite all the rhetoric, most of their oil was going to the US because it's just a stone throw away from their border. So Venezuela, if you look at it geographically, Yusuf, it's physically isolated. It has the Amazon to the south. It's got the Caribbean dominated by the US Navy to the north. And it's got a hostile and stable Colombia to the west. So even if a new global challenger sought to align with Venezuela and use it as a launch pad for mischief, the country's location doesn't allow for significant air or naval base anyway. So that's why Venezuela is not recovered today. Today is still in the doldrums. Inflation's really bad, and I think there's been attempted coups a few times as well now.
What about some of the larger countries in South America, such as Brazil, which is absolutely huge, and Argentina? How come we don't actually hear much about them, and we don't see them actually as a regional power who project power beyond their region?
So Brazil is actually the largest economy in Latin America. It's full of resources, but like much of the region, it likes to spend a lot of money on its people with money it doesn't have. This is why it has regular economic crisis. So Brazil, as you mentioned, is a huge nation, Yusuf, but its north is dominated by the Amazon, and savannas in the center of the country means most of its population live in the coastal areas. So to get the resources which are in the middle of the country, process them, and then export them, it requires immense infrastructure. And this infrastructure is needed in order for these resources to traverse all this difficult terrain. So this all requires major long-term investment in use, which has never, ever been done. That's why Brazil, this country that always has potential, for many, they say it's the richest third world country and it can get into developed world status. But what you find is it's never been able to make that transition because that long-term investments are not made. And we see a similar thing with Argentina. Argentina is also full of resources, got lots of agriculture, even got gas. But its history is one of dictatorships and coups. And the long-term investment and planning that's needed has never taken place. Much like Brazil, Argentina likes to spend money it doesn't have. So I think it's had not just crisis, but it's defaulted on its debt a couple of times as well. So these are really the reasons why you said why both these countries, Brazil and Argentina, they have lots of potential, but they've never been able to really meet this potential.
Okay, with America being the superpower of the world, it's obviously involved in all parts of the world, including South America. What is America's policy in Latin America?
So at the moment, Yusuf, you know, being the global superpower, you will always have priorities in other parts of the world. There's no competition in Latin America. There's nothing really, America doesn't need to worry about foreign powers getting influence over this region. As a result, America's been actually been a bit indifferent over the years, especially since the Cold War ended, because America's been more focused in Europe and the Far East through the rise of China. So what you find today, Yusuf, is a lot of America's dealings with Latin America is on economic issues. So because Latin America is so close to America, how can it serve the American economy? So cheap goods, cheap location to manufacture goods and then export this into America. That at the moment is really what America's policy is. So until Latin America becomes independent, until a continental power emerges, or unless a foreign power manages to get influence over a country or group of countries, I don't see that really changing.
Russia, China and Iran, they like to present an image that they are constantly interfering in this region and are players that the US should be worried about. Is this really true? What is the truth about their presence in this region?
Okay, so if we take each of these countries in turn, Yusuf, if we take Russia, Russia today is nothing like the Soviet Union was during the Cold War in the region. During the Cold War, Moscow supported, it trained numerous guerrilla groups. It provided financial support and aid. And in the case of Cuba, even tried to move nuclear missiles there. Today, Russia looks at Latin America as a region far away from its key regions. You know, Ukraine is a million times more important. The Caucasus is a million times more important than Latin America. So Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua, which were key countries for Soviet Union in the past, they're just not the same as Belarus, Ukraine, or Kazakhstan. So Russia exports military equipment to this region, but beyond that, Russia does not have the power or the capabilities to do anymore. So Russia does a good job of making this all look like a threat to the US, but in truth is Russia really has very little influence or even presence in the region. If you look at China's, for China, Latin America has resources, and China needs resources for its economic model. So China's relationship is largely economic driven. And also, again, in many ways, Latin America is the least important region of the world for China, as China has priorities closer to home. Southeast Asia, South Asia, Central Asia, these are more important to China, but China shares the border with them compared to Latin America. And the final one, Iran, Yusuf. Iran has tried to develop relations with the countries in the region, especially the ones that are anti-US. The height of this was Hugo Chavez, where Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, they had a very close relationship. But little progress was made on this, as Iran just can't project power far from home. The Middle East will always be the priority for Iran. That's the region it's in. And as you go further away, those regions become less priority. And Latin America makes Iran look strong, but for all practical purposes, there's very little Iran can do.
Finally, Adan, what are the key long-term trends you see for this region?
So three, really, Yusuf. The relevancy of this region for the global system, that's the first one. Second one, Argentina and Brazil as potential powers, and then the population. So the first one is Latin America has for a long time been on the periphery of the global system. However, as a global power is shifting from the West to the East, this region needs to make a choice. Are you going to sit on the sidelines again, or are you going to take part in the global system? And this has ramifications. If Latin America is part of the new global balance of power in the world, then that makes the region important. That makes them politically important. Countries are going to want to make relations with them. All of that has a lot of implications on the region in the future. The second one, as I said, but Brazil and Argentina have the resources, but they lack the political system or ideology to marshal resources and become powers. If they could do this, then that would change the region. It would be a challenge to America, and it would have a massive impact on the world as well. If both countries could do that individually or combined, that would really shake the global system. And the final one, Yusuf, is population. When we've discussed most of the other regions, all of them have a challenge of massive growing population. The current population in Latin America is 660 million. Now, this is projected to reach a maximum of 750 million by 2058. And thereafter, it will begin to decline. Now, the fertility rate in this region, Yusuf, it's been falling for decades, and it's currently 1.9 children per woman. And 2.1 children per woman is needed for a stable population. And the number one cause of the declining population is migration out of the region. Migration out of the region is so high that how are you supposed to develop an economy? Are you supposed to develop Brazil, Argentina, when people and workers are constantly leaving? So this is going to have a big impact. If this region wants to be powerful, if it wants to have a say in the world, it needs the economy to support this. And for the economy, you need workers and you need people. If they're leaving, it's going to be a major problem. So these are probably the three key trends, Yusuf, for this region going forward.
Thanks for your time today, Adnan. Very insightful. If you want to learn more about the issues we've raised today, please check out our website, www.thegeopolity.com. You can also learn more on many other issues. By accessing our website, you'll find comprehensive insights, analysis, articles, and deep dives. I'm Yusuf. Thank you for listening.